Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Crowdsourcing Sustainability Podcast. Last week, we hosted a panel with four amazing people who are working to make sure a transition to sustainability is equitable and just. And we, of course, wanted to share that conversation with you here as well. If you'd like to join our next live panel so you can ask questions, make sure to sign up for our newsletter and the community so you can get we can give you the heads up. All right. Hope you enjoy.
Today, we're going to be talking about equitable electrification and just transition more broadly. And this is a really important conversation and perspective for all of us to participate in and integrate really into the way that we're thinking about and acting on climate. So I'm incredibly excited to have this amazing panel of experts here with us today. These folks are really leading on multiple fronts of equitable electrification and like the just transition space more broadly. So they're bringing together knowledge and experience from the policy perspective, local, national, and global policy, from a high level, like systemic and supply chain perspective, and also from a perspective of like what's happening on the ground for real people and what are kind of the experiences that, you know, all this high level stuff actually translates to in people's lives, right? So we're going to kind of be weaving all of these threads together today and hopefully help us begin to understand the multiple levels of why equity in decarbonization is so critical and how we do it. And we'll have some time for Q&A at the end. So please make note of your questions throughout this conversation. Feel free to put them in the chat and we'll do our best to get through all the questions at the end. So without further ado, I will pass the mic to our wonderful panelists to introduce themselves, and then we will get right into the conversation. So why don't we go ahead and start with you, Johanna?
Hi, all. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm very excited for this conversation, a crucial one. As Rachel said, my name is Johanna, and I'm the executive director at the Climate and Community Project, which is a progressive climate policy think tank. We have a network of about 45 academics and researchers who are really doing cutting edge research at the climate and inequality nexus. And we at the Climate Community Project really tried to focus on, policies that you can touch, right? Things that you can see in your community that are going to help to build and empower a multiracial working class. Because we see this not only as an important and moral thing to do, but also one that's politically smart so that we can build the type of world that we need. And our research ranges a lot in terms of its focus. So we have research on housing, on care and climate, on utilities and transportation. And one of the things I'm going to be focusing on a little bit in this conversation is one of our most recent reports called Achieving Zero Emissions with More Mobility and Less Mining, looking at how the US transportation system is decarbonizing and electrifying in the most just way. So thank you so much for having me here today.
Thanks. Thanks so much for being here. And Jamal.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Jamal Lewis. I'm a director of state and local policy at Rewiring America. We're an organization dedicated to advancing economy-wide electrification, which is the act of proliferating efficient electric machines all across our economy. We're doing that in a number of different ways. I'm on the policy team, very much focused on how we're shifting policy towards those efficient electric machines.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for being here. And Dion.
Good afternoon, everybody. I want to say thank you for the team for putting on such an amazing event. My name is Dion Richardson with Community Dreams Foundation. I'm the president there. And our role and our mission is to provide access to resources and capital for energy efficient and clean energy projects in underserved communities, you know. And so, extremely important conversation that we're having today. And some of our efforts, we really try to focus on deploying resources. You know, there's a lot of new and innovative ways to get people engaged and to process the transition. And so we want to provide access and, you know, educate homeowners or property owners about those resources and assist them with, being able to attain. And so I'm just excited to continue the conversation today excited to learn from the other panelists and even some of the members in the crowd. And again, just thankful to be here.
Awesome. We're thankful that you're here. And Carolina.
Yes. So hello, everyone. I think as all panelists, I'm also super excited for our discussion. And thank you, Ryan and Rachel, for the invitation. A bit about myself. I am a geologist and I specialize in natural resources management with focus on lithium and cobalt. I am a senior associate for Systemic. Systemic is a system change company. We help design and build a better economy. We seek to bring speed and scale to transforming five systems to shape how we live and work, mainly energy, nature, and food, materials, urban areas, and finance, with materials, nature, and food being my field. And I want to bring to this conversation a perspective from the overlap of environmental and social impacts of mining activities, especially when we talk about batteries, considering lithium in the lithium triangle in South America and cobalt in DRC. And also how can we move from the extractivist model towards a more circular economy? Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you all so much. So yeah, as you can all probably see, like an amazing collection of perspectives and wealth of experience here. So to kind of start off, you know, we know that we need to decarbonize our economies, our lives, really every aspect of our societies, right? In order to meet science-based targets for staying within hopefully 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, maximum 2 degrees Celsius. And so, you know, we know beyond that point, we move into truly catastrophic and irreversible climate and ecosystem collapse. But we also know that how we make this transition is critically important, right? So it's not just a transition, it's about a just transition. So can you each kind of speak from your perspective about why the how piece of this transition is just as critical as the transition itself?
I'll jump in there first. You know, I think I like the way you said, you know, it's not just a transition, you know, it's making it a just transition. You know, that's put that on a bumper sticker, right? You know, because part of what the goal and, you know, some of the challenges are is around awareness and, you know, understanding what that really means and how this transition, this energy transition that we're under, you know, underway, how that really is not only a climate conversation, but an economic conversation, you know. And so part of some of the things that we've seen on, you know, in frontline communities is that a lot of, you know, property owners or individuals who may not even be property owners, they think that some of these resources or some of these objectives, some of the things that they can do to assist with, you know, decarbonizing, they think that those things are unattainable, you know. And so the way that we educate, the way that we create the narrative around some of the tools and resources that are available, and the way that we deploy those resources can significantly change the economic perspective. And I think when you start having a conversation around economics, that's when you can create urgency, you know, because, and that goes from all the stakeholders that are involved, you know, so whether you're talking about from a company or corporation standpoint, all the way down to the individual standpoint, I think it's critical to create urgency. And the way you can do that is, you know, start talking about economics, right? When you start talking about people's, you know, funds, you know, then you start to see actual commitment. And so I think it's just, you know, the ability for us to create some of those things and be able to assist in those areas can make it a just transition for sure.
Things down.
If I can jump on that one, I think when we talk about economy, it's really important what Dion just mentioned, because most of the plan transition are usually not ensuring a fair distribution of the costs and benefits of any decarbonization pathways that are being created. So usually who would be willing to pay that are not like actually open to pay, and natural resources are mostly based on countries where policies are and regulations are not quite well enforced, and companies who are acquiring those natural resources are not going on ground to analyze and evaluate, audit, and make sure that nothing is being violated there. So I think beyond like the economy, I think it's really important that we can ensure that the cost and benefits of the decarbonation will be fairly distributed. And that's why the how becomes important. And that's a big challenge, but I try to be a bit like, try to have a little bit of hope on that, because if we can have like a well-planned transition, it's, we can envision like opportunities for innovation, the sustainable economic growth, and a more social justice environment for everyone. But I try to be realistic as well, then if we don't plan that in a really good way, that will only have the effect that will be contrary what I mentioned before. So we will exacerbate existing inequalities, harm vulnerable communities, and worsen even more the environmental degradation.
Caroline, I think that's such a good point, and definitely one that I wanted to jump in on as well, because I think you're right. Like, it is about who holds the benefits and the burdens of our transition. And right now we're in a situation in which, like, the way that our global economy operates at this point in time is part of the reason why we have the climate crisis. And so we have this opportunity to reorder our economic systems to actually care for community, care for the climate, care for people. And so, you know, when I'm thinking about the United States, for instance, we live in, you know, what's conceptualized as one of the richest countries, but we have people on a daily basis being shut off from their electricity because they cannot pay, or they're actually in far more harm's way from these, you know, climate events that are happening far and far more often, where people at the front lines are largely marginalized communities, largely BIPOC communities that are going to be there kind of unless we shift the dynamic here. I think we have a real potential problem of seeing that we transition our richest communities, right? Like, someone who lives in a high wealth neighborhood is able to put up a seawall, but that's not true for other people. And so the how becomes really important. And to Carolina's point as well, that's, you know, I just talked about a community, right? Or a city, but that's actually happening on a global level as well. Because in the United States, we may say, okay, great, time to electrify. Let's go. We're going to get all of our cars turned over to electric vehicles. Fabulous. But what we have to think about is, what does it take to actually do that? And Carolina really brought up nicely that those materials have to come from somewhere. And we need to think about those relationships and the fabric of those relationships, because if we all go from our, you know, internal combustion engine, you know, cars, and we move us all into electric vehicles that are getting bigger and bigger, we are going to have to extract more and more lithium as part of that transition. And that actually could be part of perpetuating historic colonial relations. And how do we make sure that as we're reorganizing our economy and we have this opportunity to make massive investments in the economy, that we're using that to reorder it?
Yeah, I really love all of those points. I'm going to take a few steps back and say, you know, that was it, the intergovernmental panel on climate change has said that we effectively have to peak emissions by 2025. That means we do need to reduce our fossil fuel use. One way to do that is through electrification. And some of my colleagues found that we have over 121 million homes here in the United States that need to be electrified. And 220 personal vehicles that need to be electrified. That's a lot. And, you know, I think when we talk about the how of the transition being important, I think a lot of times it's framed as the continued and sort of maintaining the existing status quo where, you know, lower income, poor, marginalized communities will continue to bear the brunt of a whole host of inequalities, inequities, and injustices. And I think that is true. But I really liked what Dion said in that it's also about sort of economic opportunity as well. In the electrification of our economy, there is a lot of opportunity within that. And we are going to need everyone in order to achieve our goals and get to the 1.5 and below degrees Celsius. And so because of that, it is important that we're designing policies and programs with intentionality so that we can reach folks who haven't typically been part of the conversation or haven't been able to benefit from clean energy solutions in the past. And so I would like to also frame it as this is the opportunity to engage people intentionally to be part of this transition that is happening, and so they can see themselves in this decarbonized future.
Thanks, Jamal. I think that that last point is absolutely key and really not talked about enough. So I appreciate you bringing that up. I kind of also want to take a step back and just look at what the status quo is. So like, what are the economic and policy mechanisms that are currently in place governing how energy is created and distributed? And like specifically, what are the justice and equity implications of these current systems? So does anyone want to dive into like what we're working with right now and the equity and justice lens on that?
I just want to, before we kind of even get too far to the justice point, I wanted to kind of just touch on some of the things, you know, everyone kind of briefly touched on, and specifically Southern Carolina said that hope, right? You know, and that hope can be contagious. It needs to be contagious. We need to be optimistic. You know, a lot of times the old way of doing things used to be that fear sells, you know, and unfortunately people have a great belief in that. But I'm hopeful that we can create optimism around the opportunity to do things differently than what the status quo was, all the way from procurement, you know, from mining and, you know, all the way through the entire process. And so when it comes to, you know, some of the tools that are around, you know, and I think, again, hopeful thus far, you know, from, you know, a U.S. standpoint, the Department of Energy has done a really good job in a few areas. You know, number one, be able to create some innovative technology tools that are out there. And I'll speak to Jamal's organization, Rewiring America. You know, there's some unique, creative ways to facilitate. And then also, too, something else that thus far, you know, through the Justice 40 initiative that's been done is, and I think it's critical, is engagement. You know, the ability to engage all the way through members at the community level and all the way through, you know, manufacturing and production and deployment, that ability to engage, it matters because, you know, and again, just the hope that we have is that we start to see some of that engagement play out in real time. And we start to see some of these different aspects come into play that the community feels a part of, right? And that every, you know, every stakeholder feels like, hey, I have my fingerprints on that. You were able to listen in, hear some of the concerns, apply some of those things that we discuss. And that creates more hope, that creates more opportunity, that creates, you know, a kind of a domino effect that can be very, very powerful. So again, I just want to make sure that, you know, we're all on this call, we're all hopeful. You know, I'm guessing that as we leave this call, that you go out and spread some of that hope as well.
Yeah, I really love the hope framing. And in terms of the, you know, what are the existing policies that sort of define the status quo? Last year in 2022, there were about $1 trillion in fossil fuel subsidies that contribute to the reasons why, you know, at the demand side, you have fossil fuel appliances that are currently the most accessible, most affordable versions of those machines on the market today. You know, Rewiring America, we have a vision where towards the end of this decade, efficient electric machines like heat pumps, heat pump water heaters, induction stoves, electric vehicles are the most accessible, are the most affordable versions of those machines. But these subsidies are part of the reason why we have the status quo in place today. And where does the, you know, where are the equity and justice implications of that reality? Currently, and over the course of time, you have Black and brown communities, oftentimes lower income communities, who are positioned in terms of their communities right near most of the fossil fuel combustion sites, you know, across the country and across the world. And so we're seeing health impacts of that. We're seeing economic impacts of that. And the more that we remain reliant on fossil fuels, the more that reality will stay in place. And so, you know, Rewiring America, as part of our vision, we're hoping to boost the demand for efficient electric machines, recognizing that they are just vastly more effective at performing those tasks. So, you know, for example, a heat pump is between two and four times, is at least two times as effective and efficient at producing heat and air conditioning as a typical, you know, fossil fuel machine. And similar stats are true for stoves, for electric vehicles. And so they're just vastly better. And so we're trying to change that reality by shifting demand.
Jamal, I love that. And it's reminding me a little bit of what my colleague Danielle Aldana Cohen calls heat pump populism. Like heat pumps, they're like physical things you can see and you add it, and like people get stoked when they have it on their home, and it's helping to make sure that they're cool or warm at different times of the year, and like builds that hope, right? Like, oh, we can see something different. But what it gets to your question, Ryan, and this I think very much is what Jamal was saying too, is like, we're at this moment, we're kind of like mid-transition right now, where we have these countervailing forces at play, where we just got this big, you know, $370 billion worth of investment from the Inflation Reduction Act last year. Huge. It's a major thing that Rewiring America is doing a lot of work to just like let people know that it's there and you have access to it. But it's not everything, right? Like that's not enough in terms of the level of funding that we need. And there are good justice components to the Inflation Reduction Act, including specific carve-outs for environmental justice communities, for community solar, which is absolutely fabulous. But, you know, there are still so many of these incentives that are focused on homeowners or car owners. And that's actually when we're thinking about the people who are most affected by the climate crisis, about frontline communities, likely they're renters. And sometimes they don't have access to a car. They have access to a bus. So how do we think at the same time about these systemic things that we're shifting and changing so that we're also helping people who are the most marginalized? And I think what Jamal describes as well about the other force that's here, right, that's pushing back on this is the fossil fuel industry. It is the gas utilities that are coming in and trying to undermine the work that we're doing to decarbonize. And so they have held a lot of the status quo and a lot of the political power within our systems. So a lot of what we're having to do right now is unwind just decades upon decades of a policy that it helps fossil fuels far before it helps renewable energy or electrification more generally.
Just to pick up that point that Joanna was mentioning about the policies and the system change and the systemic approach that we need to have, I think we can go deep on many policies and regulations that are being developed if you want here. But I was trying to think about things that are being effective. For example, in Brazil this year, Systemic decided to do this approach with coalitions. That means putting together different stakeholders, so not only people, but also the big companies that are acting there, the bigger mining companies of the country, to discuss how they can actually move towards a more electrification and energy just society. And it was quite like after like Bolsonaro lost, now we have kind of the open way to actually bring this discussion up to make sure that policies can be, can start being developed together with people and those companies. And that ended up bringing a really good result to the country. So there was this big report called the Amazon's Marathon, Race to Zero and Race to Resilience. So mainly trying to find pathways together with the government and how to develop policies and regulations to make sure that we could achieve net zero by 2030. And like actually to make sure that the Amazon region would become actually nature positive by 2030. And bringing again the hope topic, it was quite exciting to see the results because it really looked that it's possible if we can join the forces and make it work. And answering Ryan with the policies, we are acting together with the public sector there to make sure that the policies are actually cleaning the way to apply the projects that we are running, considering the legal Amazon region. And also that includes like renewable energy subsidies, net metering, utility regulation. Some of like, unfortunately, we need to also account like carbon pricing for the companies to make sure that everyone is on board and creating more energy efficiency standards. So there's a big list of interventions that we plan to do. And it's really nice to see that when we put everyone on the table, we can understand how they can benefit and how that can actually not benefit many people and come to a common agreement. And I think the purpose on systemic with coalitions is really making things work on that way in Brazil. So I just wanted to add that and also to sum up more with the hope aspect.
Fantastic. Any last thoughts on current, you know, policy mechanisms that are shaping the status quo?
Maybe we can talk about the new CSRD that is being developed in Europe. I think it's shaping is going to be implemented in 2024. And it will become mandatory for most of the companies in Europe. And it tackles resource use, ocean and water use as well, circular economy. So that will become mandatory for companies to report certain metrics and targets in that sector. So I think that's a good, a light in, not in the end of the tunnel because 2024 is right there. But I think it's something good that is happening in development of policies and actually regulated reporting.
That's
just
great.
Real quick on that for clarification, what's the abbreviation and what does it stand for?
Sorry, is CSRD is Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. Cool. And it was developed together with EPFRAG, I guess, EFRAG actually. And they have different environmental sustainability reporting directives. It's around 7, and each of them focus on a different topic. And it's really interesting because they are also including biodiversity. That is, I think, the hardest thing to measure nowadays. And that really helps companies to see how they are actually achieving their targets. And it's creating clear metrics so we can actually measure that and don't be only in the qualitative way of giving scores to companies.
That's awesome.
Great, thank you. So, you know, you're all working from different angles and different perspectives. And so I'd love to hear a little bit from each of you about how you think about the major pillars of equitable electrification. Like, what are the kind of the critical pieces of this puzzle, throughout this whole trajectory, right, from the sourcing to, you know, getting the technologies to people on the ground?
I'll jump in again. And just to kind of even tie that, you know, some of the major pillars back to part of the last discussion, and, you know, in terms of policies and some of the way that those policies are being structured now. And I think that might've been Carolina who said it, but the collaboration, right? You know, that's something that as we start to make the transition and as we start to implement some of those policies, the encouragement and incentivization of collaboration throughout those policies and through some of those directives, I think that's really, really critical to how we transition, you know? And so something else that really kind of stood out to me was an emphasis on scalable solutions, you know? And so not only here domestically, but globally, you know? So as part of, you know, some of the efforts that we work on are, you know, creating solutions that, yes, they're gonna make an effect immediately in the communities, but keeping an eye, you know, kind of in the distant, not too far distant, but the distant realm of saying, okay, how can, you know, another team that's, you know, halfway around the world use these same structures to actually create change or assist in those areas? And so when you talk about the pillars, you know, something to kind of keep in mind as we continue the discussion is, and I think Joanna hit on it perfectly, not everybody's going to be able to transition, you know, that immediately. Because not everybody has the tools or the ownership and how critical ownership really is, but not everybody has that ownership of decision-making. And so, you know, as some of these, you know, items start to take place, as we start making some of these transitions, you know, one thing that we do is we try to create a list towards electrification, right? So including housing, including transportation, including sustainable practices. And so we say, okay, hey, here's your checklist towards electrification. We'll come in, we'll do an evaluation of your property, we'll do an evaluation of your personal finances, we'll do evaluation of your habits, right? And say, okay, here is a list of all of the things that you can do personally that will move towards electrification. And then following that up with rewarding for taking action. And so that's something that I think, you know, in terms of some pillars and some different things are, and that's on an individual level and on the corporate level of rewarding action. And that's something that if you want to change behavior, you want to get people to react, we have to create these short-term rewards. You know, the people in this conversation, you know, in the audience, most likely it's interesting. I've been on another call before where it's, we call it, that's the 50% of people who already believe, right? That's the portion of our societies who are already locked in, encouraged, and consciously making efforts, right? So it's not this crowd, you know, this is great to have these kind of conversations, right? But it's not this crowd that we've got to convince. This is not the audience, right? It's the other side of that 50% that's, you know, doesn't believe in climate change, that it's not worried about what happens in 25 years from now, right? You know, those are the individuals that we have to really start to convert over to this side of the process. And so I think having an eye on rewarding individuals for positive behavior, that's a really good opportunity to kind of create that foundational level of urgency that I think is needed.
Yeah, so from our perspective, when you think about any, you know, like newer technology, oftentimes there are early adopters, and then there's a middle, and then there are laggards, is sort of the economic, you know, the economic term. Reality plays out for a lot of newer things. For the iPhone. It plays out for electric vehicles, for solar, and I think the same thing currently is playing out for, you know, efficient electric machines like heat pumps. And so, how do we shift that? To me, it's about accessibility in multiple ways or senses of that term. Oftentimes, you know, marginalized, disadvantaged communities and residents aren't aware that these technologies exist. So we have to get the message out there, you know, what Dion was talking about earlier, through outreach, through engagement, and making sure that these that our neighbors understand that there are much better technologies out there for them. So from a, you know, from a very practical standpoint. But accessibility also includes, in this context, affordability as well. There is a premium on these efficient electric appliances currently. We're working to shift that, but the reality is that there is a premium. And so one of the things that we've really fought for in the Inflation Reduction Act are things like point of sale rebates, which is basically an upfront discount for the cost of these machines for low and moderate income households. Those are two pillars of accessibility. I think the last pillar is one in which, you know, these machines have, you know, are installed in homes, and oftentimes the home itself, the infrastructure, is not ready for this type of machine. It needs upgraded electrical service, or there are other issues that have to be addressed prior that might prohibit someone from installing an efficient electric machine. And so we have to address that too. For us, it's a matter of, you know, at the time in which their current heating system, which might be a furnace, at the time in which that dies, is that home ready for an efficient electric heat pump? And what do we need to do to make sure that that happens? You know, just to continue down this thread, that all of that is, you know, our key components of an equitable transition or equitable electrification for us. But it doesn't really stop there. This is a very dynamic situation. And I think I may have mentioned this earlier, but electrification is already happening across the country. And we're already seeing a lot of people leaving the natural gas system and other, you know, like delivered fuels for electric versions of those machines. That not only sets up the people who are able to transition to benefit from those efficient machines, but it leaves certain people behind. And so as more people are shifting from the natural gas system onto the electric system, the people who are still on the gas system are having to pay more for what they're currently using, which is also an inequity. So it's like, not only are you being prevented from shifting, but you're being penalized for that too. And that's not fair either. So how are we addressing and making sure that we're being intentional about this transition, such that, you know, the people who are still on the natural gas system aren't being left with stranded assets and stranded costs, but instead are able to carefully and intentionally transition over to a much better system.
Jamal, just wanting to jump off of that, because I think like the piece you bring up around gas and our relationship with electrification and gas systems and stranded assets really speaks to the need in this moment to do more planning, right? Like, we can't do this in a like fully market-based, you know, like individual action. We need coordinated action that's happening in a systematic way so that we aren't going to see those the crevasse of people on two different sides, or like people accumulating the harm of like being stuck on a gas system that's not adequately taken apart and managed, its decline is managed. So I think that's just like such an important component of how we have to think about electrification, and is actually a pillar is planning. And another thing I was thinking about in terms of a pillar, right? Like, we can think about this sectorally, like, okay, one pillar is transportation, another is housing, another is industrial processing, right? And the other thing we can think about is like planning, you know, investing in institutions, investing in new companies, and doing that kind of industrial policy work. It's investing in labor, right? And like ensuring the jobs that we're creating are also high roads jobs, thinking about the supply chain associated with that electrification. Like, so there are a couple of different ways and like Venn diagrams that we can work with in terms of deciding what those pillars are and how we think about about like what it looks like to actually go from where we are today, which is, you know, on the cusp of electrification into a fully electrified system.
Thinking also about, again, the systemic way, I think is something that really nice that you are always bringing, because it really connects with everything that I'm doing right now. But I would like us to think a bit that we should think also in most of the countries that you cannot just switch to electrification without planning. So I think it's really important that you brought the topic of planning, because we cannot switch to electrification that fast. For example, most of the countries in Global South are mostly driven by truck transport, and they are basically diesel based. So to do the transition, usually the pathway would be longer than what we wanted, and that would be harder to without socioeconomic stability, because even if we placed a system for electric vehicles, it would make even harder to people without a political and social stable moment in those countries to actually allow people to buy those vehicles, to actually maintain that. So I think planning is really crucial, especially when we talk about the countries that are producing those raw materials that are feeding those batteries. So it's also a tricky point that we need to tackle there, where most of those raw materials coming from countries that are actually not having electrification being implemented. So that's something that we also need to think on, how we can actually extend the responsibility to the producer to actually apply and invest in those countries where they are extracting those raw materials to actually pivot the electrification there as well. Another point that I would like to bring is how we need to think about the externalities that we have. For example, now with the war between Russia and Ukraine, we could see in Europe, we know that we are talking about like a country that is relatively stable economic, but we could see the effects that that had in the energy prices. And I could not even imagine how that would impact direct countries such as the one in the Global South. So I think we also need to think about energy systems and energy grid that are more resilient and they don't rely that much on external transference and transboundary management of energy. So we need to think about ways and being more self-sufficient and don't like crash with any externalities.
Awesome. Thank you all for that. We're going to switch gears a little bit here and dive into alternative futures. So, you know, we've covered what we don't want to do and why it's critical we don't repeat past and current patterns. And let's get into now, like, what are the alternative pathways for a just energy transition that prioritizes both people and the planet? Like, what is the world that we can build if we kind of like get this right at every turn? And let's start with Johanna on this one.
Yes, Ryan, can definitely jump in here. This is something that Climate Community Project, we are thinking about a lot. And in our most recent report, we actually played with those futures. So to give a little bit of context, this report was focused on the United States, and we were looking at, okay, what's the pathway? We are getting to zero emissions. We made a target. We are getting to zero emissions in the transportation sector in the United States by 2050. How do we get there? And usually what we see in the literature and what we noticed was that it was really just about, okay, just that people assumed, you know, okay, well, you know, everyone's just going to keep on going in electric vehicles. That's how it's going to go down. There are no alternatives here. And we wanted to kind of push on that a little bit. And the reason we wanted to do that was thinking through some of what both Carolina and I have been talking about today in terms of lithium extraction and the material needs associated with the transition. So we asked the question, is there a way to both achieve that decarbonization target and lower the amount of lithium extraction that's necessary? So actually offering up alternative futures. And so we had a group of industrial ecologists, political economists, and transportation equity and justice experts come together in a team to actually model this out. And we modeled four different transportation futures, one where we go with the status quo and we're just doing a one for one, you know, everyone who has a vehicle right now, internal combustion engine, then gets into an electric vehicle. And those cars, as we're seeing in the United States, keep on getting bigger and bigger and bigger on the current trajectory. That turns out takes a lot of lithium and will actually be hard for us to be able to decarbonize fast enough because we're going to run into supply chain issues, not let alone the indigenous rights issues, the potential of serious social chasms that occur from that, the amount of extraction that's necessary. Then we looked and said, okay, well, what if we were to just limit the size of cars? It turns out in the United States, if you just limit the size of cars, we can limit lithium extraction and achieve full decarbonization by 42%. Then we asked, okay, what if we invested far more in mass and active transit? If we actually made our cities far more walkable, made sure that more buses were on the road. That takes electric vehicles off the road and puts people, hundreds of people, into one big bus getting all around town, which has also been proven that that's a justice intervention too, because that means that folks no longer have to rely on their own individual car. We can increasingly we're seeing fare free transit in cities. DC just made all of the buses free. That's incredible. And that's what we could be seeing, is actually much easier to get around. So we said, okay, wow, that could limit it by, up to 66%. And then if you add in recycling and think about how we're continuing to use these different things, we saw that between our four scenarios, we could limit lithium extraction by 92% if we combined those different pieces in comparison to the worst case scenario, and also achieve that decarbonization that we absolutely need to do. So I think when we're talking about the future, there isn't just one pathway to that full decarbonization, to that electrification. There are ways for us to actually embed equity along the way in the decisions that we make. And I think that's what a lot of us have been talking about today, but it's very clear in the US transportation sector where we desperately do need to decarbonize, because it is the sector that is the only growing sector of emissions in the United States. And it's actually 27% of emissions in the US currently. And if we are able to do that amount of limiting of lithium and meeting decarb rules, that means that we are going to be able to far better recognize indigenous rights, both in Latin America, where much of lithium comes from, but also in our backyard. There are lithium extraction that's happening in places like Thacker Pass in Nevada and in California itself with the Salton Sea. So this isn't just a faraway concept. This is, the extraction is happening in our backyard. And that should give us also empathy for people who are in, for instance, the Global South, where we are extracting from as well.
Okay, just to add on that, because I think that's a really interesting topic, is super interesting that we think about other ways of actually getting lithium. Because once it's extracted, it's not that it's not there anymore. It's just placed in a different product. So I think that's where we can start thinking about how we can implement circularity in this sector to actually decrease the extraction there. We can improve the design of cars, as mentioned before. We can think about ways of recycling. We can repurpose that battery at the end of the life, because when the car is not useful anymore with the battery can be useful for other things, such as in households. So we can repurpose that battery instead of just disposing it. And other ways of actually going to look for more raw materials would be urban mining. So it would be mainly recovering valuable materials from electronic waste. And that's also another option. We can look into substitution to see alternatives that we can reduce the demand of these materials, so associate lithium with other types of metals to make sure that we can have the same efficiency, but with different metals, and seeing a way that we can actually apply circular economy in this value chain would also be extremely important. And again, the EPR thing, it's quite a key here because there's currently no control what happened with the end of life of those cars when they reach that point. So that would be something that if they could have a take back scheme or something on that way would also support and decrease the lithium extraction.
That's the circularity is always something that I think sometimes gets left out of the conversation, when you start thinking about some of the challenges or problems. But I think it's important to always go back towards how we can create that circular opportunity around what we're doing now. In terms of the, alternative future, right? I get excited, I get excited thinking about some of the breakthroughs in technology, specifically, everybody's, may or may not have, gotten a tap on the shoulder about ChatGPT or generative AI, but those tools provide us, not only now, but as we kind of move forward, they're going to provide us with exponential opportunity to create new solutions that aren't even available to us right now. And so when you think about 25 years from now, often I'll try to do these exercises where I'm like, okay, well, what happens when, we get there, right? What happens when we get to the finish line or the quote unquote finish line? It's exciting, but it's also, there's a whole host of challenges that comes along with those tools, right? So you being aware of that, but then also, getting involved with them now, so I put that challenge out to not only our panel group, but to the rest of the audience that, we should all be, tapping into some of these really, really unique and innovative development tools to ask for solutions, right? You bring your challenges, bring your problems, bring your, some of the barriers that you experience or that you're aware of, bring those barriers to a product or a technology and start, just tweaking and playing around with asking, hey, how do we solve for this? How do we solve for, a just transition? How do we solve for electrification? And then thinking about that, then I believe that once we get to, 10, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, I believe that we can reach our goals. That's the one thing of, human nature is, survivalist, so as the more and more of these, unfortunate climate realities happen, the more I think people will create more urgency. And out of that, more solutions will be created. And then as we get into the future, there's going to just be an awesome opportunity for, if there's still an if attached to that, right? If they're used wisely and used responsibly, but there'll be an also awesome opportunity for abundance, right? Where energy and, is available to everyone, if energy is available to everyone and we live in a digital society, in a digital world, just imagine how much access that can provide, and how those tools, that are becoming more and more available, how they can actually streamline resources into the hands that need them most and allow for innovation to happen in those areas. Just speaking from experience, when you come from an area that is in some of these underserved communities or that have, are on the front lines, whether it's from climate disasters or extraction points, it is very difficult to innovate when you are in those conditions. You have a very difficult time thinking about hope and the future and thinking about solutions. You're dealing with current problems. You're dealing with survival. And so in order for us, and I think as we start moving past that, right, and just from our conversation, what that looks like in the future is if there's an abundance of energy and access, guess how much innovation can be created, after that point, right? You know, because now those people who were living in a survivalist mentality now can create, you know? And so that's something that I think, you know, has yet to be unlocked. And I think that, you know, as we start, you know, getting, you know, again, with the planning in place, with the responsibility of making sure it's just, with some of the responsibility of eliminating biases, you know, not only in our policies, but then also in our tools and technologies. I think that as we, if we accomplish some of those, you know, those objectives along the way, I think it's going to just completely unlock, you know, a world of abundance and hope. So again, I'm an optimist. So, what, you know, what do I know?
I was at one quick point because I thought that that was very sufficiently answered. But I think it's, you know, when we, as we achieve our goal of getting to an all electric future, I think along the way, it's important that that like we've been talking about, the economic opportunity is dispersed, you know, evenly, justly, and fairly. And that means the proliferation of new clean energy businesses accessibility of good paying, family sustaining jobs along the way. So that's all that I would add.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you all for painting the different pieces of that picture for us. We're getting to the end of our time, but before we move into Q&A, I do want to wrap up with a last question about action and you know, what people can do to support and advocate for a just transition and decarbonization. So, you know, we've talked about some pretty high level stuff here, and I know that can feel overwhelming, right? Like, we're dealing with a global energy economy, which is like a massive beast. But what can, you know, the people in this room do to kind of advocate for the kind of equitable energy transition we want and need? What are the kind of most important actions that, you know, quote unquote, regular people can take? And what's the power that we all kind of as citizens hold to affect change on this issue?
I can start. I would say take stock of the appliances in your home. And if they are, if you have a furnace or a boiler and they are above 15 years old, probably time to start making a plan. I like the idea of making a plan that Johanna was mentioning earlier. Make a plan to transition to an efficient electric machine. And that includes, you know, trying to seek out an energy audit, getting at least three quotes from contractors if you can, and start to have those conversations now so that by the time your machine dies, because eventually it will, you are ready to make that transition. And we've created a tool that will be helpful. It's a calculator that shows you how much you could get through incentives from the Inflation Reduction Act. And so that tool is meant to be a guide and help you envision what it could look like to start your planning your electrification journey. So those are some steps that I would take.
Awesome. Thanks, Jamal. And just to kind of put everyone's mind at ease, we'll include all of the links that people are mentioning in the show notes and everything like that. So we'll make sure that you have access to the things that have been mentioned.
Just really quick, and I'll try to be brief, you know, I'll piggyback off of what Jamal said in terms of, you know, he mentioned taking stock, right, of what, you know, what your personal surroundings are or use case. So I'm gonna add to that and say, lead by example, right? You know, if you start to create action with your own, you know, internal actions, your mindset, you start to become aware of what your energy consumption looks like and how, you know, where your energy is being produced, and start to develop habits around not only sharing information, but holding, you know, local, you know, leaders accountable, and then being able to follow up with that by showing your individual actions are responsible and leading in that right direction. I think that's something that, you know, people like, because we have talked about some high level, macro level, you know, challenges and some solutions too, but that can be overwhelming. So if you just focus on self first, just focus on what you're doing, focus on how you are consuming energy and where your energy is being produced, then I think that will become contagious, because as you're doing those things and people in your network, in your area, your community start to see the benefits reflecting off of you, then they'll say, oh, wow, man, you said you've been saving money. I noticed you've been doing these different things. You're able to take another vacation, right? How are you able to take that vacation? Well, you know what? I was able to save on my energy costs, you know, or you know, my house looks a lot better, right? I got brand new windows and doors and you know, that looks nice, but guess what? It also saved on my energy consumption, you know? And so as you start doing some of those things, then I think that it will start to create that domino effect of, you know, and then collaborating with others around you and say, hey, if I'm doing it, my neighbors, they're, you know, Tom is doing it, Mary's doing it. And when all three of us go to a council meeting or the municipality or the state government or the federal level, and we, you know, collectively go, you know, there's a strength in numbers to hold those other individuals accountable and say, hey, look, you know, we've already taken the steps. We need you to further make sure that these other steps are taken. And, you know, like Jamal said, that, you know, just by simply taking account for what you're doing, what your electrification process looks like, and then sharing as much information as you possibly can with others, I think that's just a really good start.
Okay. Also to add on the personal surrounding things, I think so small things that we do in our daily basis, it can also help. For example, resell your electronic waste. It can also be something that will generate money and we will be saving energy from recycling. And more on being active, on being aware, on following public hearing calendars, so we can be more active on the decisions as well. I think that's quite important. And trying to be more collaborative on sharing. I know that many people cannot switch for electric vehicle, but you can like decrease your impact if you're sharing a car or sharing your way, your commuting habits, or just sharing anything in general. But when I think about how to I can scale up that impact, and the ways that I'm trying to do in my life is mainly getting together people and actually to go to the public hearings and actually put our opinion out there and look for companies that are aligned with my values. So if I understand that system change will be the way to actually improve our impact in the world, I will look for a place where I can actually work on that as well. And trying to build coalitions, not only related to the company that I work with, but like on my private life. So make sure that I'm creating connections with those companies, with people that are engaged, people that are on ground working for those companies, and making sure that we have a clear pathway together with the governor as well. And trying to put those people at the same place and see how we can improve energy sector together and make energy accessible and affordable for everyone. I think that's the first, like the way that I think that we can have like a higher impact beyond our inner circle.
Yeah, thank you so much, Carolina. And I'll echo what folks have talked about when it comes to just like the importance of collective action. You know, there is the individual action that you can do, especially if you are someone that has the wealth to make the decision, but standing in solidarity with the people who cannot, who don't have access to that, right? Like if I think about the Inflation Reduction Act, it's a massive amount of money that is available, right? But it's all carrots. It's not sticks. It's up to us on the local level, at the state level, to advocate, to put the sticks in place, and to compel our leaders to take up the opportunity that has been put forward at the federal level. So that means, you know, organizing your community for, I'm seeing in the chat here, someone asking about, you know, finance. There's actually a massive amount of money to help start new public green banks in the Inflation Reduction Act. You could go and like campaign to ensure that your city starts a green public bank and gets access to that federal funding. So I think that it's like, it's both that individual action and then standing in solidarity. And even, you know, for when it comes to things like public transit, often we're seeing these crucial parts of our electrification future being undermined or underinvested. And, you know, that means like, if there are local workers or like local bus workers who are on strike, you know, because they aren't getting the wages they need, go show up at that picket line, do the work and get to know those folks, because those are the types of relationships that we need to be building across labor lines, across community lines, so that we can build the power to win.
That's great. Thank you. And yeah, let's, you know, you started to touch on some of the questions in the chat, and let's go ahead and get into those. Is there anything else that folks want to say about this question about, you know, recommendations for publicly financing this transition? Is it or privately, or like, you know, what are the kind of the funding pathways that we want to be advocating for here?
Go ahead, Dion. Sorry.
No. You first. You're inside. So you got the inside scoop. I'll follow your lead.
I don't know about all that. but I think that there are, the one thing I'll say is that there are a lot of, and Johanna was just mentioning this, there are a lot of people who can and will be moved by things like low cost financing or tax credits. And so I think it's really important that we are getting the most out of that as a society, like making sure that people who can benefit from tax credits and can again, start to transition with low cost financing, actually do so through those pathways, so that we can have like super targeted public financing and direct publicly subsidized programs for those households and communities that can't afford to do that. So that to me is just a basic structure. For anyone who can benefit from tax credits and low-cost financing, do that. And then we can collectively work towards putting together and developing and implementing, again, like hyper-targeted programs.
Great.
Yeah, see, and that's why I let him go first, right? Because that's extremely insightful, you know, and some of the legislation that got passed domestically, it really does a great job of kickstarting, you know, some of these financing challenges, right? You know, and to Jamal's point, not everybody, you know, can benefit from the tax credit, or not everybody can benefit from financing. You know, traditionally in other areas, those things have been, you know, selectively allocated only towards, you know, a small, whether that's a majority of individuals or a minority of individuals. And so I like that Jamal kind of wrapped that up with, but the people who are eligible for those things, please take advantage now. So then that way we can identify and see where those gaps are. So we can start to provide gap funding for some of the other, you know, individuals who still need assistance. And it's a term, you know, that in policy work, you know, you guys will be familiar with, is braiding funding together, right? You know, and so that's really part of what our role is to identify all the incentives that are out there for individuals and for commercial property owners. So any grants, any rebates, any tax credits, or any financing opportunities that are available, and then trying to braid all those different things. It's going to be, you know, every property is going to be different. Every personal solution, or every solution has to be personalized to that individual. And so we need to braid those things together and say, bring awareness of where they're at. So even as we work in this field and work towards this effort, it's extremely difficult. I mean, we're using AI technology to identify some of these things, and it's still very hard to identify because they're so scattered across so many different platforms. You know, again, Jamal does a really great, his organization does a great job with that tool that he put in the link, or put the link in the chat, to be able to calculate and let you know what might be available to you based on your personal situation. But then if you look at some of the incentives and a lot of those dollars, not only here domestically, but you know, globally, if you look at where dollars are coming from, as they are being allocated in those areas, you have to go to each one of those individual municipalities or communities to find out what's available specifically to that community. And that information is completely scattered, and it's not, you know, the data is not clean, it's not organized. And so, you know, those are some of the challenges that we're working on, but we're certainly, I mean, we work at this stuff every day, but we still don't have, you know, still not complete. So to, you know, to that question's point, you know, it is something that we have to focus on, and what you can do in the audience is just start locally with, you know, identifying what your municipality or area, your community, what they're offering, and then expand out. And before you pull the trigger on anything, identify all your options, right? I mean, you don't, you know, you might have a tax credit or a rebate for a heat pump, and then you might be able to get some financing for solar, and you might be able to get a rebate for an EV vehicle, and you might not need a charger at your home because the city's providing charging stations. So you have to be aware. You got to go out and seek the information to increase your awareness of what's available to you. So it's a great question, though. And I'll kind of leave it there.
Thank you so much. There are some other great questions in the chat, but I'm aware that we're at our hour and 15 minutes, and I want to be respectful of everyone's time. So I think what we'll do is, you know, I'll save this chat, and if it's okay with the panelists, I'll kind of send these questions to them via email and get some answers for you all and get them to you in the follow-up to this conversation. But to close, I'd love to just offer all of you an opportunity for any kind of last calls to action, last kind of, you know, nuggets of wisdom that you want to leave us with.
No, I just want to say thank you. I think it was quite an injection of energy for the end of the day here. It's really exciting to see how hopeful everyone is, and not only hopeful, but also thinking about strategies and how we can achieve that together. I think it was a great opportunity, and I'm really looking forward for what comes next.
Yeah, thank you all so much. I've really appreciated the conversation. If y'all are interested, climateandcommunity.org has the research that I referenced today, as well as other pieces of research, and definitely call on everyone to keep on organizing, keep on fighting.
I'll just kind of say, you know, I appreciate everybody who jumped on today. Appreciate, you know, you guys for putting this panel together, and thank you to the panelists for, you know, engaging. I always feel like, you know, I get too deep into it because it's so important to me. So I do apologize if I, you know, if I've used too much of the time, but you guys can find me on LinkedIn. You know, I don't have any other social media, but I am active on LinkedIn and open to engaging and doing individual calls like these. I think it's important to have those kind of conversations, and I love ideas. So please, you know, continue coming up with new ideas, and let's, you know, collaborate.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Jamal's been generous enough to drop his email in the chat as well. And yeah, you know, links to all of these folks and the amazing work that they're doing will include all of that with the recording of this conversation. So you'll have kind of all the resources that you need to continue your learning and your engagement on this issue. And thank you so much to our panelists for your time today, and also for all the time that you spend doing the incredible work that you're doing, you know, moving this really important piece of this bigger puzzle forward. Really grateful for you. And thanks to everyone who took the time to be with us and listen to this great conversation today. I hope you kind of carry this forward, and that it weaves itself into the way you think about climate and take action on this issue. So thank you so much. I hope to see you all soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.